Well, let's begin with the preliminaries and on to the Bodhicitta Vivarana. And we'll ask our local, relatively local North York, Umzi, to lead the charge there. Okay?
The four thoughts that turn to mind from samsara. Da da di da do dan zan di chi ne yang yang make a way. Da re la make a zong gi. Go on du te shan dong ja. Da te ren jen lu di yang. Chi da du ki dra dong way. Nam shin in fa mi da yi, da san mi ta shu ti ta. Ko re ne de ka ke kyan, pe re ko ka ma shi pe. Si pe da la mi ta wa, nyan nam de pe lam du cho. Da jo lu di dan den chu, Yang mong du su mi ge pong, ge we la le ve pa ki, go san dong shi dong ba su mi.
As this excellent body of mine with leisure and endowments will be difficult to attain repeatedly in the future, right now we will accomplish the state of the unsurpassed amount of Vajra to meaningfully benefit others. Also, it is not certain when the hateful enemy of this present precious body the morrow of death will arrive. I and other beings are impermanent, the time of death being uncertain. Since there is no opportunity for happiness wherever one is born in samsara, and since a happy existence was never seen, we will enter the path of nirvana. In order for this body with leisure and wealth to possess meaning, we will abandon the three non-virtuous poisonous afflictions, develop diligence in virtuous actions, and protect the vows and the commitments of the three doors.
Going for refuge? Namo Dakshan Nam Kenam Pe San Shenam Nudi Nisong La He Jajuba Chin La Kam Jo
to the Adam, the bestowers of Supreme City. We go for refuge to the Dakini, the speller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dharmapalas, masters of activity. Namo. Now, until the attainment of unsurpassed awakening, I and all other sentient beings equal to space go for refuge to the Guru, source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the Adam, the stores of the Supreme City. We go for refuge to the Dakini, the speller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the Sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dhammapalas, masters of activity.
Generating bodhicitta. Always, 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 always Sata samaya manupamaya dhanza sata tenupatishta dhidomibhava sitakaya mebhava sitakaya mebhava anarakta mebhava sarva siddhi nikaya sarva karma sichane chitam shriyam kuruham ha 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 ho bharavan sarva tatagata Ha 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 ho bhagavan sarvata tagata vendra mani mucha vendra bhava mahasamya sadhuto ha om vendra sata samaya manupalaya vendra sata tenapa tishta dvita me bhava sita kaya me bhava sita kaya me bhava Anurakta mevava sarva siddhi nikrayata sarva karma sichane tisam shriyam kuruham ha 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 ho bhagavan sarva tathagata vendrama menucha vendrava maha samya sato Guru Yoga.
Mandala offering.
Right, we'll do the mandala offering.
Excellent.
Sa, sa, shi, pu, chu, chu, shing, me, to, tram, re, la, ling, shi, ni, de, yam, pa, li, sam, de, shing, da, ni, te, and adore the singer in the four continents as well as the sun and the moon. By offering the visualized Buddha field, may all migrating beings take birth in the pure Buddha field. Om Guru Deva Dhini Radha Mangala Dhati Jaso. Guru Yoga. Om. Unceasing inner radiance is one's own brighter energy, the root guru, to whom we supplicate with a devoted mind, bless us to accomplish the rainbow body. In the Buddha field of one's own originally pure awareness, the palace of unceasing inner radiance is one's own vibrant energy, the root guru, to whom we supplicate with a devoted mind, bless us to accomplish the rainbow body.
Let's see if anybody has any questions before we start back into the commentary by Nagarjuna on bodhicitta, the mind of awakening. No questions? Okay. Oh, yes, go for it.
It's on the last page of the Padmasattva text.
Okay.
Around the Buddha powers.
Yeah.
Just wondering about the practice around that.
Normally, I haven't received that, and Antrim Shri didn't make comments on it. Normally, what you do is you visualize, and it's a standard for many of the practices. You visualize the skull garland Lord in the different colors. So you visualize in blue, yellow, red, and green. That's how it's done. And there'd be sometimes there's some substitution of the mantra for that, but normally that's how it's done. And most of the practice texts have it. You just change the yidam to being a different color for a different Buddha family of one of the figures in the mandala. Mm-hmm. And again, it says if you need it, if you really need it to bring it on, then for instance, let's say you wanted to strengthen your abilities or the abilities of others for riches and increase and the ability to unfold, then you would visualize yourself and the skull garland Lord, Yabyom, in a golden color. That's how it would be done. Or a red color for power and for magnetization, for bringing things to you or others. And then the figure would be green if you're working with fearlessness and overcoming obstacles and wrathful activities. That's usually how it's done.
So you would go through the sadhana the way it is, just replacing that visualization?
That's right. That's normally how it's done, but all you see is a quote from the root treasure text. That's all. And that's just the standard method. And there's no inner yoga for this, so then you would place different figures in the centers, but that would be my guess. Probably a good guess. One of these days we'll get around to asking Antrim Shri. Since he didn't comment on it, he may just pull exactly what the treasure text says. Yeah. Just substitute the figures for the different colors. Yeah. Any other questions anybody has? All clear? Oh, good. And is the text, the Bodhicitta Vivarana, pretty clear and straightforward? Yeah? Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Question around consciousness.
Sure.
And distinguishing consciousness from mind and the function of consciousness in mind's recognition of mind.
Yeah, Standard, very good question. So we have different words. We have consciousness in English. We have mind. We have awareness. We have these different words. But what do they mean? So you can either go to Western psychology and Western neurocognitive psychology and cognitive psychology and try to look those up, or they may mean different things. You can go to Eastern Buddhist texts, and there's quite a bit written on this. In the early Abhidhamma, there is not. The definition for consciousness, I mean, it's right there, but not mind. The definition for consciousness is that which takes up an object. So it's very straightforward. Consciousness is not some ultimate thing. It's a function of the five skandhas, which always takes up an object, always conjoined with an object. However, in the sutta teachings, the Buddha did make reference. There's a sutta called the Prabhasawa Sutta, and in it he makes reference to the luminous mind. So it's clearly there, but in the Abhidhamma tradition, the only, in terms of real mind, real thing, is Nibbana, free of constraints, free of binding, unborn nature. So when we come to the Mahayana teachings, the Chittamatra teachings, and so on, there's now a clear exposition and clear definition of mind, awareness, wisdom mind. All these terms start to come in because they were clearly seen to be fuzzy at the beginning. And did they debate them? Did people talk? Well, sure they did. But there wasn't really a clear definition around them. So when we come to the Mahayana Abhidhamma, around the time of Asanga, we start to see the much more definition around what constitutes wisdom mind, what constitutes relative mind, and so on. So from a Buddhist standpoint of meditation, excuse me for the little froggies in there, from the Buddhist standpoint of meditation and meditational philosophy, remember all Buddhist philosophy is based on meditative experience. It's not constructed from theory. It's all grows out of great yogis and yoginis' meditative experience, deep meditative experience, and trying to figure out what that is and systematize it. So a consciousness is not the ultimate nature, as it sometimes is portrayed in Western circles. Mind takes it, but then they're very clear about a relative mind and an ultimate mind. Okay, so this is where there are treatises, for instance, by the third Karmapa, distinguishing consciousness from mind. So there's treatises on this, especially around the Mahamudra tradition and Dzogchen tradition. There is incredible clarity around this point to understand consciousness, the function of consciousness, mind, and wisdom mind. So, in that sense, consciousness is considered subject-object consciousness, whereas there's a consciousness, we usually use the word mind, which is more like ultimate consciousness. So there's many consciousnesses. So for instance, in the Buddhist tradition, the Mahayana tradition, there are 8 consciousnesses. There are references later on to 9 consciousnesses, which are mind, reflections of mind. So we'll proceed. So number 28 on page 3. Does Brahm, did you get a copy of the text?
No.
Does anybody have an extra text at all? Maybe. I may have one. I have an extra text. So, Bram, this may be a little mysterious to you, some of the terms. Just easefully ride along with it. Yeah. The imputed, the dependent, and the consummate. They have only one nature of their own, emptiness. Their identities are constructed upon the mind. I prefer of the mind, not upon the mind. Of the mind. However, that's another debatable point. And also, you could easily put in their identities, but also their imaginations. But that gets confused a little bit sometimes with the imputed. But we'll work through this. This part number 28 is crucial to understanding the Yogacara or the Chittamatra point. So we have what's called in Chittamatra three natures. They posited three natures. Unlike others, they came up with these three natures, of which there is the imputed, the dependent, and the consummate. Instead of consummate, I would prefer what most people use these days is absolute. And really, the imputed is you have to look at normal translations and other translators trying to make attempts at new translations. So the normal translation for imputed is imaginary. It depends on the school. Sometimes the Buddhist school, different translators will use different terms. You can usually tell which school they're from. You can tell it's Galupa. Usually Galupa trader, they use the word imputed. But if from the point of view of most translators, it would be imaginary. Or inventions of mind, imaginary, instead of imputed. So that's I would put that as B, and I'll tell you there's a reason for that. Just the way this is often explained, I'd make imputed number B, dependent is number A. And dependent is a good word. The reason being is it's short for dependent on causes and conditions. That's actually what it means. Dependent on causes and conditions. And C is the consummate, the absolute, not dependent on causes and conditions, or absolute emptiness, which, remember from last class, is the self-aware, self-illuminating mind, which the Chittamatras, that's the terms that they use to describe this ultimate mind, which is self-aware. In other words, it reveals everything, it illuminates everything, and is the pure nature of emptiness. So these three natures, I'm going to give some readings from that, but these three natures is the dependent nature is like the light play on a movie screen. So it's not so hard to understand. You can't have, if you look up, I'll give some different examples that he gives in text and so on, but if you were to look up in a movie theater and look at the light coming from the illuminate, from the projector, and going through the dust motes, you don't see the movie, do you? But you see what appears to be illumination, right? But independence, this is crucial, independence on the screen, the image appears. Without the screen, the image doesn't appear. Now you may say, well, it'll appear on something else. That's fine. That's because we have different senses. So depending on something else, you may hear the music but not see it. Depending on something else, you may smell the movie, especially if the projector is burning. You may smell the movie and not see it. You may touch the movie if you put your hand up, you may, oh, that feels warm or something like that, and go, I'm touching the film. But we have the same thing all the time, but we just don't realize it. We have images, or we have experiences that are due to causes and conditions, whereas we think that the entity or the image, the movie on the screen, is actually a real entity with its own internal actors and activities, right? It's got actors in there and actresses. It's got scenery and all kinds of things, does it? No. It has nothing like that. It's not possible. It doesn't have anything like that at all. If you look at the film, or the now they don't use film so much anymore. They send around, I think, hard disks. But if you look at the digitized version, there's no scenery. There's no actors and actresses there, is there? There's no dialogue. And yet it appears. It only appears under dependent or interdependent conditions. This is really crucial. It's basically the major theme of the Theravada Abhidhamma. It's really at the heart of the Theravada Abhidhamma. You don't have things happen. You don't have arising or passing away unless there's dependent conditions. None of us are in this room without what? Dependent conditions. We can't be in this room without dependent conditions. There's people that set this retreat up. There's people, there's staff, there's a board, there's a history, there's people that built this room. There's all kinds of conditions that you are in right now, in a theater, if you wish, that have to do with each other, have to do with the Lama, have to do with the technology we have for Zoom, those people who are Zoomers over there, wherever they are in space, they're dependent on new technology allowing that to happen. Does that make sense? So too, if our physiology changes just a little bit, we don't hear the Dharma talk in the same way. We don't hear the Dharma talk. We don't see the Dharma talk. Just a little bit of change in physiology. Okay. So the very narrow parameters, very narrow constraints by which things actually happen, or very broad constraints. And what we experience is the thing happening of itself, when in fact, nothing is like that. If you know that, as a not just a meditative experience, but as a really profound insight, your life has to greatly change, because that's called emptiness. There isn't anything happening outside supportive causes and conditions. It just doesn't happen. And if you know that principle, you also know when to act. You also usually know when not to act. You know when to get involved, when to back away, when the time is right, when the time isn't right, how to bring things together, how to leave things alone. Some things can't ripen without fertile soil. Is that making sense? Some things ripen very quickly in fertile soil. Sometimes you have so-called fertile soil, but you don't have the right micronutrients and other conditions for things to arise. Mm-hmm.
Throughout the text, the translator is constantly referring to emptiness, naming emptiness. Is it assumed that he's really naming empty luminosity, as they're both complementary of each other?
Not necessarily. So like many words, the word emptiness is the translation of the Sanskrit shunyata, or Pali shunyata. That word can have 16 different meanings depending on the context. But it always means, and the reason why emptiness is a good translation but misleading for many Westerners, but a good translation is empty of. So depending on the context and depending on the turning of the wheel of Dharma, the perspective of the Dharma that's being taught, emptiness can mean empty of afflictive states, empty of greed, hate, delusion. It can mean empty of entity. It can mean interdependence and paticca-samuppada. So depending on the context, even in this text, empty, the word emptiness, which is shunyata, will slightly change in meaning, not right, not wrong, but the flavor of what it's pointing to will change depending on the context in which it's given. All right? It's very important to understand that. So always remember, there's no word emptiness. It's a translation of the word shunyata, and shunyata as a word in the mind of a human being is conceptual. Okay? It's pointing to reality.
In verse 28,
mm-hmm.
It finishes up by saying, only have one nature of their own.
Yes.
Emptiness.
That's right.
But emptiness cannot be known without the luminosity aspect either.
Yes, it can.
Complementary to each other.
No, they're not. Ultimately, they are for Buddhahood, but there are many beings who experience emptiness without the luminosity aspect. If you don't practice the inner yogas, if you don't do certain practices, if you're not introduced to certain principles, then you can easily miss the luminosity aspect but have very good experiences of emptiness. Ultimately, the emptiness of a Buddha is the unity of luminosity. We wouldn't say the unity. It's empty luminosity. The word emptiness, shunyata, is a finger pointing. But the word emptiness is not real. The word emptiness is another concept. But it's a very high concept. Yeah,
I was just tripped up by it saying, because they're saying they only have one nature.
Correct. There only is one nature of everything. All of you in the room are only of one nature. It's called emptiness. There's no two natures. But the diversity, a manifold diversity that emerges out of emptiness, is utterly extraordinary. And no matter how diverse you get, no matter what country you're from or what culture, how you speak, what your language is, no matter whether your mind is inflamed with afflictive states or calm and tranquil and clear, it's still one nature. It simply doesn't matter. But emptiness itself is experienced by the wisdom mind in different facets, like light being dispersed from a diamond. Making sense? That's why we have a dorje. That's a symbol of dorje. Those five prongs of a dorje are the five wisdoms. That's why there's 5 points. 5 wisdoms. All the same nature of emptiness, but display differently in light and characteristics. Okay. Not so? We'll carry on. So I think we left off yesterday with my 9th point. It's not a 9th point in a text. It's only my 9 point to give some clarity to this. According to the Chittamatra system, the mind that realizes there are no separate perceiver and perceived entities in a moment of consciousness is the wisdom mind. So take this as provisional. You may latch onto it and say, aha, when I have the experience, when there is the experience of no separation between perceiver and perceived. By the way, that's just the way it is. if you even take a moment of logic, you'll see that there is never any separation between a perceiver and the perceived. That is the wisdom mind. But you have to have the awareness of that, and the question is that the ultimate wisdom mind, or is this one aspect of wisdom? When this wisdom mind arises, there is no longer an appearance of such separate entities, and so the base consciousness, the alaya vijnana, the storehouse of consciousness, is said to be purified. It's purified of duality. At this point, only the self-illuminating, self-aware aspect of each moment of consciousness arises, and these continue as a pure stream of radiant, clear moments of consciousness. So this is not the same as tranquility. One has to really be clear about the difference between tranquility and clear seeing wisdom. Clear seeing wisdom has a knowing aspect. Tranquility has an abiding aspect. There's a real difference. The mind lighting up in awakeness is different than the mind spacious and light in tranquility. They're both the same mind, but one knows the nature. Okay, so if I could have the apple again, Travis, as a prop. Apple prop. Like these props. Use the apple, I think, for about 20, 30 years. It keeps arising, so there we go. We have the apple. When we look at an apple, we sometimes go, whoa. When we taste an apple, especially if an apple perhaps is fresh off a tree or it's been freshly picked, it's actually ripe, actually a really ripe apple, we may go like this. Whoa. And we're in a kind of very tranquil, awake state, right? You ever had that? An extraordinary piece of fruit, doesn't matter what it is. But that's different than the wow, or even the non-wow, the appreciation of the nature of the apple. You'll say, well, what's the nature of the apple? The nature of the apple is the same nature as an orange or a kiwi fruit or an Asian pear. It has the same nature. The nature is the knowledge of the inseparability of appearance and mind. It's the knowledge that this, in fact, is an experience of the mind, not something separate. Getting it? So it's not just biting into an apple and going, oh, I got the essence. What's the essence of all experience? That's the question. So that experience and moments of that clear knowing purifies the alaya vijnana, purifies the ground of consciousness from dualistic, conceptual, karmic activity. Since the Chittamatrans were such great meditators, their ideas arose from their experience through meditation. They're often called the Yogacharans. The yoga refers to meditation. When the meditator rests his mind in its emptiness, that's with awareness, free from dualistic concepts, not no thought. I have to say this a couple hundred thousand times in my lifetime. No thought is different than free of conceptual contrivance. I say it over and over again. No thought is very good at no thought. It's called blankness. Free thoughtful wakefulness, awareness of the nature of mind and thought, is very different. So it says here, according to Gyamso Rinpoche, is lovely, one of the great yogin, great scholar, free from dualistic concepts, not no thought, he experiences the natural spaciousness and clarity of awareness, not of the experience, but of awareness. So the confusion is, are you experiencing awareness or are you experiencing the glow of the object? When you bite into a really delicious fruit, you have the glow of the object, but not the glow of awareness. If you have the glow of awareness, you will see that no matter what you look at, whatever you hear, whatever you taste, you could have burnt waffles, you could have burnt toast, whatever you come in contact, it doesn't matter, a piece of poo, it's absolutely the same extraordinary experience of awareness, not the object. You see that? That's the key. If you were to have that experience alone, this is very good advancement. And it's not that you go up and you go, look, poo. I've seen people do that. They thought, oh, I'm a good yogini. Poo. Oh, no problem. I have no problem with it. That's not it. It's neither problem nor not problem. It is one experiencing the nature of awareness with all forms on the movie screen. So let's go back to the movie screen. This is direct instruction. If you experience the images on the movie screen, then you're caught up in the images. If you experience the nature of the movie screen that can have any kind of movie, correct? Is this correct? If you go to a movie theater, they can show any kind of movie. And that screen may have shown 150 different movies and on its way to 1,000 different movies. What's the nature of the screen that can display an infinite number of movies? That's the key. And if you get that, you have it. Then you can abide, as it says here, you can rest the mind not in the object, not in the movie, but you can rest the mind in the glow, in the luminous nature of the screen that can display everything. Free. Listen to this. Free to display everything. Display everything. Yes.
So from this state, from this view, how does one make choices on the relative level?
No problem at all. You can still tie your shoelaces, and you can still, because of relative cause and conditions, you can still bite into an apple and say it's not ripe. But one still is abiding in awareness at the same time. So this is the key of what's called the two-in-one principle. Just because you see the nature of the screen by which all appearances happen doesn't mean you can't have excellent discerning consciousness. So that is why one of the wisdom consciousnesses of the Vajrayana mandala is called discriminating awareness, which is Amitabha. Right? Otherwise you can't function. Otherwise you've now given up your sentient consciousness. So it is said that even Buddhas can also taste. But they don't necessarily cling to that taste, even though they can describe and say, that is better than that. Otherwise, how would you ever become liberated? If you can't know that that is actually relatively better than that, then there's no, as Guru Rinpoche said, there's no hope of liberation. But if you don't rise through that eventually and say, there is no better than that, there's no hope of liberation. So one comes before the other. To gain liberation, one has to sort out what is relatively better than the other for awakening. But eventually you have to drop the good and the bad and those differences. But that doesn't mean that you can't still do it. If you look at the minds of great beings, Asanga, Nargujuna, these great yogis who are considered to be highly awakened beings, they were excellent at both discernment and a non-dual experience. So the high point is to have both simultaneously. You can go back and forth easily. Yeah. It's a very key point. If you can't, and you're lost in a non-dual view, you may actually be in a non-dual conceptual view. It may be tainted if you can't function well. If you can't function well, if you can't make, as numbers of you can't make a cup of tea, then there's no way. You have to be able to make a cup of tea. You have to be able to sort that out. And then, of course, if you can't do that, then there's no way you can be a compassionate being for others, because you'll say to people when they come to you and they ask for your help, you'll say, have an apple. We'll say, but what do I do with the apple? Have an apple. Like in the movie The Matrix, have a cookie. But no, I don't want a cookie, I want an answer. Have a cookie. You'll be fine. Of course, ultimately you'll be fine. Whether you're there, whether they shoot you, whether they kill you, whether they bury you, whether they dissolve you in the movie, doesn't matter, and they shoot you full of million bullets, you'll be fine. It won't matter in The Matrix. Yeah, but I got other questions, see? So, there you go. Let us continue. Mm-hmm.
So going back to Chris's question, would contemplation of the causes and conditions help in terms of understanding the relative? Or does it just naturally arise with the...
No, there's intelligence space, because you have to explore life. You have to see how cause and conditions make better outcomes. How cause and conditions sometimes make worse outcomes. Like a balance sheet. There's good balance sheets and there's poor balance sheets. And poor balance sheets make it difficult to do things. And good balance sheets make it possible to do things. So one needs the intelligence. People say, oh, this is not about intelligence. No, this is about very clear seeing intelligence. One needs to be able to sort out what in relative life leads to the wholesome, what in relative life leads to the unwholesome, what in relative life leads to the beatific, what in relative life leads to the unbeautific. These are the jhanic states. What in relative life will lead to the dawning of the unborn primordial wisdom, what in relative life will not lead to the dawning of primordial wisdom. That's all. So therefore we have the teachings of the 37 factors of enlightenment. People say, well, I'm just going to sit here and meditate and experience the non-duality. Yeah, but there's cause and conditions for that. So, or I want to be free. There's cause and conditions. So the Buddha is very clear through 40 years of teaching that there are 37 factors that must come together for the experience of the unborn to dawn. These are called merit, mostly merit. So we gather these. We gather these. If we don't gather things, have you noticed that sometimes? Let me give you an example. Let's say we wanted to make a wonderful cappuccino for somebody. Yeah? We have a great espresso machine. We have wonderful coffee. We have an excellent grinder. We have a trained barista. The machine's on. We have electricity. We're at the Dharma Center. We have electricity. And we want to make a cappuccino. So we make the espresso. We have the espresso in a cup. It's absolutely magnificent. It smells glorious. It's wonderful coffee. We reach into the refrigerator, but there's no milk. Therefore, there are no causes and conditions for the cappuccino. Does this make sense? That means the mind was not putting together the factors of merit that would make a cappuccino. Therefore, we can't make a cappuccino. Or, here's another example. The night before, nobody smelt the milk. So you open the refrigerator, you pull out the milk, and the milk is sour, and you pour it in, you go, oh, I'm sorry, I can't make a cappuccino. The conditions aren't right for the cappuccino to emerge. So you have a cappuccino, but nobody can drink it. And you say, so it doesn't matter, does it? It doesn't matter. Smelly cappuccino? Non-smelly cappuccino. Curdled cappuccino? Non-curdled cappuccino. Doesn't matter, does it? Or does it? it ultimately doesn't matter, but it matters for a relative being trying to wake up their mind. And it matters for compassion and loving kindness. And one of the factors, the 37 factors of liberation is what? Mindfulness, recollective ability, and loving kindness. So these are key. So if those don't come together, no matter what you do, you can meditate, you can even have no thoughts from time to time, but still is not moving towards liberation. How's that? Yeah? Now, the dependent nature. The moments of consciousness, including both the subject and the object, or the perceiving and the perceived aspect, are called the dependent nature, because they arise in dependence on causes and conditions, like reflections that appear in a mirror that can only rise in dependence on the objects they reflect. So a beautiful experience you can do all day is keep stopping and asking yourself, how is this experience possible with just one thing, with one cause? How does this arise? Or you can do this over and over again. Take a mirror and keep passing the mirror in front of your face or somewhere where you can see yourself, saying, this does not arise unless there is a mirror. You have the light, you have all the conditions. But unless there's a mirror, there's no arising of self-image. Isn't that cool? Then you can take the mirror away and say, try this. How does this experience of self arise without a mirror, the mirror of the mind? If there's no mirror of the mind, there's no self arising. Which mirror do you hold up? What mirror do you hold up when you go, me? Me, in a fraction of a second. In probably 15 milliseconds, what is it that arises that goes, me? What conditions? It's cool. Just try it. Try it all day long. It's pretty fantastic. So one thing I sometimes do with people is, hey, if you want to try this, It works really well for some if you take an edge, like the edge of wood or something, or the edge of a wall where it comes to the ceiling, and just slowly look at the edge where the wall and the ceiling comes together, or some wood edge. Wood's edge is good, it's got more definition. And slowly move your eyes and see how the experience arises. Be good. And you will see, if you look very closely, that there's times when there's no experience there. Then there's times when it comes back and you may say, well, you don't even notice that. Unless it's pointed out, you won't notice it. It's too fast. But if you really slow down, you'll see that there's a complete dropping out of the experience, has to refresh itself. What's it refreshing on? So, everything, all of our experience, arises in interdependent causation. So why would you ever go on retreat to the Dharma Center of Canada? For only one reason: dependent cause and conditions. Tranquility and insight usually have a better chance of developing here in a blessed, tranquil, forest-like setting than in a busy city with the noise, the things that can catch your attention, the distractions, I'm not saying it is or isn't, perhaps even the amount of radio frequency radiation, which is huge in a city, just the rumbling all the time in a city like this. People say, oh, there's nothing happening, it's very tranquil. No, it's absolutely always rumbling. The number of beings and alone of conflicted mind states is enormous within a city. So that is why the Buddha said, never have places of meditation, viharas, in cities. The Buddha, that was 2,500 years ago, when cities, what would be the largest city 2,500 years ago?
Kinmount.
About the size of Kinmount. That would be a city. Okay? And he was saying, don't do it. Don't have meditation retreat centers in cities. Go to the forest, go to the country. And it makes a huge difference. I mean, it really, really does make a huge difference. Is it impossible to meditate in a city? No. But is there a better possibility, a profound, deep unfolding in a natural setting where you have a chance, your physiology has a chance to unwind? One fellow, remember years ago, came up here from the city. And he looked pretty stressed out. And he came up for an interview. This is maybe 20 years ago. And he said, or maybe more, I don't know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 20 years ago. And he said, could you give me a meditation to do? I'm here for the weekend, long weekend. I said, sure. You know, you could count your breaths. And he went into the cabin. And I saw him, he came out on Monday. He says, that was incredible. That was incredible. That meditation was so amazing. I said, what meditation did I give you? I was like, I don't know. Yeah, breathing, you know. I sat there and I heard things. And really what he described was just relaxing and unwinding for a weekend in the country. He hadn't been to the country for so long. And he was basically always describing as being in a cabin, going for walks and relaxing and unwinding. And being out of the city. And I said, really, it wasn't the meditation. It was just, you're in a wonderful place conducive to the cause and conditions that will let you relax, let alone meditate. So, I mean, I'm really happy. Was this week one? We finished week one?
Yes.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no idea. Retreats just blend to me one or the other. But you're all the same. Just one giant life retreat from one or the other. But I think kind of the end of week one. And are you beginning to relax more? Yeah. So it's not just the meditation, not just the teaching, it's simply being in a place where you can, you're relaxing in the weather and even getting used to the weather up here. Yeah. So then eventually you can get down to actually meditating. They are conditioned by the past actions of the person whose stream they constitute. So, not only are we having fresh cause and conditions, but they're all interacting with the alaya consciousness, the storehouse of consciousness, of not just your conditioning, but of entire cultural's conditioning and history's conditioning. Many of us go, well, yeah, I'm a North American, but you're carrying thousands and thousands of years of English history, of Italian history, of Norwegian history, Middle Eastern history, of Middle Europe history, all these kinds of things, plus the epigenetics is carried on through families. My anxiety, that one day will go. You don't have your anxiety, you have an entire history of anxiety. So I say to Jews, yeah, no, you do. And you're gonna say, well, oh, that makes it worse. No, actually, it makes it easier. It makes it much easier. People say, my anxiety, not your anxiety. Anything but. You live in a whole culture of anxiety, a whole history of anxiety. I often say to Jews, when Jews say, God, I have anxiety. You should have a lot of anxiety. You know, the whole population of Jews has been through like one world war after another, and you know, burnt to death and incinerated, and of course, yeah, on the run for a long time, or stuck in in ghettos for a long time. Yeah, you should be. never know, you know, the history of Jews, you never know when it's really good, right? And everything's going well and culture's flourishing for 80, 90 years, and then the king or the, you know, some prince owes a lot of money to the banker and goes, "You're all leaving, including the banker. You're expelled from the kingdom." It's one way to clear up the debts. So, standard method was just get rid of the banker. You know, if you get rid of the banker, then you don't have any debts. It's really, really simple system.
$750.
Yes. Yeah, we won't go. 700, was it 300 the year before, I think, yes. In taxes, is that what you're referring to? Yes. I read that. That's quite something. We won't go there because it will cause perturbations and waves of arising and so on in the various yogis and yoginis that have assembled here. So there's no experience separated from the conditions of the movie screen. If you have a torn movie screen, you get a torn movie. Your mind has to then fill in the blanks. If you try to fill in the blanks of my grammar, you can do it, but sometimes maybe not. And you go, "What did the Lama say?" You say, "You know, what did you really say?" Let me repeat myself in a sentence that maybe makes sense. But are you following? So the more there's deterioration of a movie screen, the less clarity there will be. Do you see? The fuzzier and worse the projector is, the images won't come out. Making sense? Somebody dropped the projector that day. The hard disk or the film is deteriorating. Or someone went out and bought, instead of buying a really cheap cotton sheet to show the movie, they went out and they bought a $3,000 fine grain screen with little, have you ever seen that? Little tiny glass dots on it. Beautiful. That's what we used to use for showing slides and movies. If you look very closely, it was a fabric screen with tiny little glass beads in it, like microscopic glass beads. They made beautiful movies. But when we went to, you remember in Greece and Italy and places like that, home movies where you put up a piece of cotton cloth that isn't ironed? Everybody's going, "Wow, that's a really good movie." You get the idea? So causes and conditions. Cause and conditions. The separate entities, which we call mind and matter, the screen and the image, are simply inventions. In other words, they are the imaginary nature. So when you look at the image on the screen, that is an imaginary nature. When you look at the screen, it too is an imagination. They're both the same nature. They're both emptiness. Does that make any sense now to you? Both the image, the movie on the screen, the sound, and the screen are both the nature of emptiness. They have no real attributes. What's the screen made of? I don't know. It's probably vinyl or polyvinyl, right? It's made of molecules and atoms. It is not a screen. In fact, it is a concept. Okay, so these three natures is the way in which the Chittamatras explain things. Okay, a very good point here. The absolute truth is the emptiness of the mind of these entities. This is called the truly existent nature because that emptiness is what truly is. So what's the truly existent nature of the screen? Emptiness. How do you know it's a screen? Mind. Mind is capable of knowing it's a screen because it's empty. If the mind wasn't empty of if the mind wasn't ultimately empty of cause and conditions, what would happen to all of us? we'd be stuck. There'd be no possibilities. We'd be repeating loops that would look like very complex loops, but they would be basically robotic loops. We don't have that experience. We have an infinite number of possibilities. How many paintings are possible on this planet? Paintings.
Infinite.
Good. How many different dishes of food could ever be served?
Infinite.
Do you get the idea? How many shrines could be set up? Infinite. How many different kinds of houses could be built? Infinite. Apartments, infinite. Furniture, infinite. Gemstones, infinite. Flooring, infinite. How about human design? Has anybody ever seen an identical human, even when they're an identical twin? No such thing as an identical twin. Cool, isn't it? It's really something. Why? Because mind is open. It's not closed. There's no such thing as closed. It's completely, utterly open. Okay, another example, which I think this is a lovely example, which I've given a number of times, but it's beautifully put here. Another example would be a film of a tiger or a snake. The concept of a real tiger or snake is the imaginary nature, the concept. The mere appearance of the tiger or snake, that is the light playing on the screen, or in the form of a tiger or snake, is real, and is the dependent nature. It's relatively real. Okay? So one can think of the screen as the dependent nature. Everything depends on having that screen. Okay, let's go further, which I've done, but this well put here. Maybe two examples. The emptiness of the mere appearances, in the sense of their merely being light on the screen, empty of any real tigers, or empty of an actor or an actress, is the truly existent nature, empty of any real thing. So when you look at a movie screen, what he's saying is, when you look at a movie screen and it dawns on you that there's no Gone with the Wind movie, there's no tiger in the screen, there's no emotional content, there's just the play of light, and it's all fabricated by mind, you have it. You may have ruined the movie for yourself, but you have it. And the same thing happens with dreams. When you suddenly wake up in the middle of a dream, inside the dream, and you go, have you all had this experience? I hope you do. You wake up in the dream without waking up, and you recognize clearly that all the images in the dream are of the mind, that this is a dreaming mind with created images of a mindscape. Congratulations. This is very important. Okay? That's different than lucid dreaming. Lucid dreaming is everything's very lucid. Okay? But here, there's the insight that, in fact, all the actors and everything that appears in the dream is in the sphere of the mind, is born of the sphere of the mind. Gets a little deeper, but I think I may leave that for, we'll go on to other points. Now, some of you may be asking, so if the ultimate nature is the ultimate emptiness, and it's the ultimate thing, then how could it be absolute, because things are transitory and so on. So they get out of that by saying it's not a thing, and it's a nature, and natures are not things. But others get them for that and say, you're kind of creating another self-existing phenomenon. Is everybody following that point? You know? The screen is empty. The images on the screen are empty. What one has to find is the mind that is free to have these things arise. So the typical way of getting out of the anxiety of life is stop everything. So if you want to stop anxiety, what would you do in a movie theater? All of you wise beings, if you want to stop the sorrow, the anxiety, the hopes, the dreams, whatever you're going through, what would you do in a movie theater? Pardon?
Get up and leave.
Get up and leave. But the theater, the movie's still running. And you may end up in another movie theater. What would be another way? Which you're not allowed to do, but what would be another way to do it?
Go for the projector.
Pardon?
Go for the projector.
Go for the projector, pull out the plug, yes?
Yes.
Okay, and the movie stops. But do you now have a real insight, or have you just stopped the movie? You've just stopped the movie. Is the movie going to start again? Yes, the projector. What were you called when you were a... Were you a projectorist?
I guess so.
I guess so. When the projectorist will come and put the plug back in and start the movie again. Do you see? So you haven't solved the fundamental problem. What you've done is you've tranquilized the problem. What's the fundamental way to break the loop? Whether the movie's playing or not playing, what do you have to really do? You have to know the nature. Whether the movie's playing or not playing, you can be in the theater like this. Not stupid, just like this. Whether the movie's on or off, whether the film breaks. Ever had that when the film breaks in a movie theater? And you're like this. That's nice. Here's the test. If you're served waffles with fruit and, you know, berries and fruit, and there's yogurt or whipped cream on top, can you handle the waffles without maple syrup? That's the test. How many of you would not break down? How many Canadians? Especially Eastern Canadians, would not break down into a fit of utter despair. Well, you may not be able to relate to this. This is a very Eastern Canadian example. But there's some here that may not be able to withstand the onslaught of that particular challenge. Okay.
Can we try?
The Dharma Center needs to get a whole bunch of waffle machines. Especially industrial waffle machines. Number 29. On page 4. Number 29. To those who delight in the great vehicle, in the Mahayana, the Buddha taught in brief, selflessness in perfect equanimity, and that the mind is primordially unborn. Okay. I'll repeat that again. To those who delight in the great vehicle, the Mahayana, the Buddha taught in brief, selflessness in perfect equanimity, and that the mind is primordially unborn. Well, let's add a few words. Okay. When it says selfless in perfect equanimity, I would not choose the word equanimity, because equanimity is often used for relative balance and not being swayed here or there. When it becomes a wisdom, it's in Mahayana, it's called the equality of all phenomena. In other words, you are in perfect equanimity not because you're in a state of balanced energies or you're feeling loving towards all beings, but you can taste the emptiness of all phenomena. So the term is usually called the equality of all phenomena. Let's look at some other translations. 29. Let's see. I haven't looked at them today. See. You see here, the no self of phenomena, their evenness. I would prefer that. Their evenness in nature. Yes, here's another translation. To bodhisattvas who rejoice in the Mahayana, the Buddhas present in brief the selflessness and equality of all phenomena. That's what the term means. Okay? They can rest, that is, bodhisattvas can rest in the equal nature of all phenomena. So if you want to know where evenness, now at a certain age you may not want evenness, but at a certain age sometimes evenness is kind of a nice thing. If you want to rest in evenness and not be jostled all over the place, there's one is to be tranquil, but the other, which is more stable, is to know the taste of all phenomena. That's called a wisdom attainment. And I would put in 29, the last line of 29, I put in, and the teaching that the mind is primordially unborn. Yeah, Lintner does. He puts in brackets, and the teaching that mind is originally unborn. One other translator says, and said the mind's primordially unborn. So I think that makes it clear. And the teaching that the mind is primordially unborn. So by experiencing again and again primordially unborn mind or primordially unborn experience, then one has the equality of all phenomena. All right. Number 30. Any questions on that? Number 30. The proponents of yogic practices, that means yogacara or chittamatra, the proponents of yogacara assert that a purified mind effected or done through mastery of one's own mind and through utter revolution of its state is the sphere of its own reflective awareness. Okay, so we need a few minutes on this. I'd probably change mastery to transformation there. Don't really have a problem with mastery, but you can't, you know, to master your mind means it's kind of like muscling it down. Whereas here it's a natural condition, so you're not mastering, you're almost unmastering. But so what they mean here is taming. When the mind is tamed, and transformed. I don't think anybody else is using there's one, mastery of one's own mind. Here's another. Lintner's, the Yogacarans give predominance to mind in itself. They claim that mind purified by a transformation in position becomes the object of its own specific knowledge. This refers to the transcendental turning about of the mind in its seat. So to be able to see mind, literally, the mind, not only conditioned mind, not only needs to change, but literally the mind has to flip about and see its nature. So when I say one has to bite into the apple, experience has to bite into the mind. As opposed to looking at the mind, one has to come around and eat the mind, subsume the mind, enter the mind. Otherwise, one is on the outside of the glow of the mind called bliss, clarity, and non-distinction. So the Mahamudra instruction texts are very clear on this. You can get very, very close to mind awareness, pure awareness, by being excellent in bliss, clarity, and no thought. But you may still be on the outer glow of that experience, like the warmth of the sun, and never penetrate the sun. And that is why it's called penetrative insight practice, not vipassana. So in the Vajrayana tradition, the term is special Vajrayana or penetrative, because you have to penetrate into the nature of mind, not stay on the surface, not see its states. So, and through an utter revolution of its state, utter revolution of mind, utterly transformed. Transformation in position, I would say, transformation of conceptual contrivance. The concepts have to fall. Okay? So the old term that's been used for years in many texts and Western descriptions is called turning about in the seat of consciousness. I'm sure some of you have seen that in books and things like that. Turning about in the seat of consciousness. It's actually a very physiological experience. You know, whenever we drop concepts, whenever concepts fall, we undergo physiological changes. It's not separate from physiology. So to gain great view means that our physiology has to undergo changes. So if you're undergoing physiological changes in retreat, I go, congratulations. If you're undergoing too many physiological changes, I may say, you may need to go to the medical center or take a break. But actually, to undergo eruptions of physiology and changes, both calm and real fierce changes, is a very good sign.
Mm-hmm. Are they saying here that the purification is through effort?
Yes, exactly what they're saying. You have to make effort. It is on the relative level that the path is attained. The path is a path of causality. When it comes to Vajrayana, it's a path of causality and a path of non-duality, both.
So what is the effort to penetrate?
The effort to penetrate is to have the best possible states and the best view, conceptual view, to see what you're not seeing. That's why there's been beings who have actually liberated upon hearing Dharma. Because the conditions are right and they just needed to change the conceptual framework for Dharma to become apparent.
So it just lands.
It lands. That means their consciousness literally changes. So, in the same way, that some people have been stuck to go through a doorway, until someone helps them go through a doorway. Right? You know what I mean by a doorway? That can be anything in life. So I think all of us experienced a good friend, a therapist, a teacher, say something to you, and either immediately or a month or 2 weeks or a year, you go, you don't even remember it was said to you. You just go, well, yeah. Well, it was pretty obvious, wasn't it? Have we all done that? Gosh, that was pretty obvious. I could never wear shirts like this. But maybe after a year or two, you know? You go, yeah, I can wear shirts like this, or, you know, or I could use Zoom to teach Dharma classes. That's possible. Are you following? But to actually go through the wall of conceptual appearances and the solidity is going to require change. It's going to require physiological change. It won't require new food. It won't require getting the food right. It won't require getting the breathing right. It won't require getting the sex right. And it won't require getting the sleeping right. You can rid yourself of all those. But having the right physiology and eating good foods for you and sleeping well. Do you see what I mean? Breathing well, good sensing, breathing, right? Good sexuality. All those things will help support the change of concept. But you still have to have the pith instruction, you have to still have the right conditions, you still have to practice. So thank you for that. Yes, the word effort is crucial. You have to purify. There's no way around it. And then you have to develop the attitude that purification is beautiful. Oh, not another sadhana practice. Why can't I just do my bare mind practice? Well, it's because there is no difference. And purification, the more you purify, the faster the dawning of primordial awareness comes. That's just the way it is. Then it says, is the sphere of its own reflexive awareness. That's like discovering the power of a mirror. Do you know what a mirror can do? Mirrors are great. You know what a mirror can do? It can reflect anything. Isn't that cool? And here's another thing about mirrors. Kind of like face guards. Anything you throw at it, except for a stone, it bounces off. So, even though the mirror reflects everything, nothing gets stuck to a mirror, and the mirror doesn't contain the images. Isn't that cool? That's why it's one of the greatest, fastest ways of awakening, the mirror. Our minds are just like a mirror. So here I'm going to give you a practice. I want to see if anything sticks to the mirror of your mind. I want you to look. Go for it. You can sit quietly like this. You can stand, you can walk, you can lie down. However you do it, I want you to look at your awareness and see if anything sticks to your awareness. Instead of going, oh man, I got so much clinging, I got so much I can just hear, it's like almost like Jewish whining or something, you know. Oh man, I got so much clinging, so much attachment, and so much this, and so much that. Where? Not in awareness. Only by concept and memory do you have all this attachment. Go look at your awareness. Go see. I want any of you to, I'm going to put this to a challenge. All are challenged to do this. Is there any fragment of stuff stuck to the mirror of the mind? Or are you going to turn around and say, yeah, well, I had a memory. But a memory is not your awareness. I'm feeling sensations, therefore I'm having. No. Look at your awareness. Do clouds ever get stuck in the atmosphere? Let's see a show of hands. Yes, clouds get stuck in the atmosphere. Let's see a show of hands. Yes. Have you? Have you seen a cloud stuck in the atmosphere? Stuck. Can't get away. Can't move. They're that way for like ever. Man, it's terrible, eh? See the clouds? It's like a pink cloud like that, and it just won't go away. You've seen it, right? Yeah, it won't go away.
Big dark one.
Big dark one won't go away. Anybody ever see a big dark cloud won't ever go away?
In my mind.
Clean your glasses.
Yeah. Time to clean the glasses. Big dots, right? Big. No! Have you all sat for hours making sure that no beautiful meditation, by the way, it was a beautiful classic meditation. Namjoon Poche, remember one evening Namjoon Poche gave it out? Yeah. Said, you do this, you won't believe how fast you'll awaken. Just stay and look and see what clouds do. No cloud gets stuck. And yet what happens to all of our thoughts and feelings? They feel like they're stuck. Not even possible. Is there ever a movie to get... when you were a projectress, Laurel, did a movie ever get stuck to the screen and you actually had as your duties to clean it off? I mean, is that absurd or what? I mean, imagine that the projectress, one of their job duties is they scrape at the end of a movie the movie off the screen. I mean, is this nuts or what? So all this clinging and dukkha is impossible in emptiness. Do you see? In the nature of emptiness. Only by a relative mind can dukkha happen. So what are you so worried about? Really? If you take the view, if you actually understand and have the view, you're not worried. That doesn't mean you don't take care of relative things and you don't hold relative things that are important.
Relatively.
Relatively. Exactly. You understand relatively. Good. Relatively good. Yes. It's good. It's a good food. It's a good person to be with. Excellent. I surround myself with good people. Excellent. Good book. Right? Good practice. Good Dharma Center. These things, yes? Good Tonka. Right. But ultimately, there's no sticking in the mind. It's a mirror. Just like a mirror. Very, very crucial. So, own reflexive awareness. Awareness, primordial awareness, innate awareness, reflects like a mirror everything. But there's not a shred of stickiness. You have to find that. That's your job. My job is to help you. You have to do the work to get so used to bathing in reflexive awareness as the natural unborn condition. That's the way the mind always is, and get used to it. That's why we do long retreats. Day after day after day, until you walk away going, that is the natural condition of the mind, and it's been that way for the last month. So that when something comes up, you're not fooled. Yeah. Months, 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 months. Own reflexive awareness. Number 31. That which is past is no more. Is that right? Can you hold on to the past? People certainly try. They work at it. Boy, do they work at it. Yeah. Keep dredging it up. There it is. I can see it. Lama Mark once gave me a rotten apple as a meditation. Lama Mark once gave me a rotten apple. There it is. You see, it's still there. Where? Where? If I throw the apple, can it stick anywhere? You'll say, well, it sticks to the wall. Will it come off the wall? Yeah. Oh, I've got a point for you here. Can anything be stained? Anything be stained? Not with the best German stain removers. That's an ad. Really good, you know, these really good chemicals for removing stains. Does anything actually bind ultimately? No. If you change the entire chemical composition, yes. But a lot of stains can be removed if you have the right stain remover. That which is past is no more. That which is yet to be is not obtained. It hasn't happened. As it abides, its locus, its position, is utterly transformed. So how can there be such an awareness in the present? Yep, not but not really. Okay, so first of all, there's no way that you can actually have any contemplation of the past. It's not true. It's gone, right? You think you can, but it's gone. Can you have any contemplation of the future? Real. It's imaginary. It hasn't happened. Okay? And since the state or the experience is in constant flux, where is it in the present now? So where is the present? Go find the present. It's another way of saying it. Go find the present. Okay? So in this way, the way it's translated is, how can there be such awareness in a location which is utterly transformed? How can you find it in the present when the mind, when something shifts from place to place. So let's do the contemplation out of this. Is mind stuck, or is mind flowing, or is mind neither? What do you actually have an experience of? Is mind the same from moment to moment? Is it changing from moment to moment, or is it neither changing nor stuck? What would you say? How can there be such a awareness in the present? And if the present is an entity, is a thing, how could it actually be there? It can't. It's not possible. This is not possible. Right. Let's look at some other translations. 31. But mind that is past does not exist, while that which is future is nowhere discovered. And how can the present mind shift from place to place? How can the unborn mind shift from place to place? How can it move around?
It can't.
It's not possible.
So the time experience is illusory.
Totally. The mind, if you want to say something about mind, it's more like a movie screen than moving around. It feels like it moves around, but there's just reflections in the mind. Just reflections in the mind. Here's another point. If we go to Toronto, and we just travel to Toronto, and we're now in Toronto, has anything changed the mind? No, just the appearances. Getting the idea? Just try it. Now that's a beautiful practice to do. It's a really beautiful practice. Is just move around on the property, go for a walk, get up, sit down, and go, has the mind changed? Watch, it's easy. Sitting like this, you finish a session of meditation, you get up. Bless you. Whatever that is. And has the mind changed? Location. Or has the experience in the mind changed?
The appearance of it.
Yeah. And how big is the mind? Is the mind here? Is the mind here? Is the mind here? Is the mind here? Or is the mind wherever experience is? How big is the mind? Big mind or small mind? Number 32. Whatever it is, it's not what it appears as. Oh my goodness, what words of wisdom. Jill is not Jill. Monique is not Monique, certainly maybe not the same age anymore. Right? Travis isn't Travis. Not at all. Have you had this experience? How many times have you had this experience in your life and you keep going, it is the way I think it is? Is there anything at all that you can find that is the way you think it is? How many things can it be that you are holding in a fixed concept? So, let's try it. How many ways can you give function or concept to something around you? Let's just take anything. Just going to reach for anything. What is this? I know you can say, don't you have them in your own country, but what is this?
Tea light.
It's a tea light. What's a tea light for? It's for lighting. Could the tea light, so Patricia says, for lighting. Okay, anybody else in the room? What's it for?
Illuminating darkness.
Illuminating darkness. What's it for?
Having
Decoration. What's it for?
Heating.
Pardon? Heating? Yeah, we've heated a cabin with a candle. Tar cabin. We've actually used it as a heating element because it was really cold. There was no electricity, and there was a candle. And if you stay really still, you can actually get a little warm. What else is it?
Ritual.
It's a ritual. What else is it?
A hat.
Very good. Hat. Okay. Got a hat. What else is it?
It's a cup.
It's a cup. Yeah, very good. Right. They make excellent cups. What else? What else is possible?
Paperweight.
Pardon?
Paperweight.
Paperweight. Yes. Excellent.
Birthday
what else?
Birthday candle.
Birthday candle.
A weapon.
Which?
A weapon.
A weapon. Yes.
Weapon.
Yes. Could be a weapon. Mm-hmm.
Piece of art.
Piece of art.
An idea in the mind.
Idea in the mind. Is there anything truly there? Truly there. Is there a tea light there? All right. Whatever it is, it's not what it appears to be. How many appearances could you have for a single thing?
Infinite.
How about people? Ever had that experience with people? I know who you are. I know what you're thinking. I know what you normally do. Then you get surprised. Ever get surprised with people around you? They did what? They did what? Wow, that's really cool. They're not thinking like I think. They just saw that or heard that totally different than I did. Yes? Is anything at all like what it is? No, not in this being's experience. Not even the slightest. Consciousness is devoid of selfhood. If you look at consciousness, can you find any self? No. Consciousness. Consciousness takes up an object. Is there a self in a consciousness that conjoins with an object? Right? Seeing? Seeing pillar. Where's the self in seeing pillar? I see pillar. That's not actually what's happening. There is a pillar seen. Everybody getting this one? There is a pillar seen, not an eye seeing a pillar. There is seeing of a pillar. There's hearing of a voice. There's smelling of a sound. Where is the eye in the smelling of the sound, the hearing of a noise, the touch? I touch. No such thing. There's touching. Yet consciousness, 32, yet consciousness has no other basis. It's empty of base. It's emptiness. All right? 32, let's look at some other translation. Just how it is, that's not as it's perceived. And how it's perceived, that is not how it is. Beautifully done. Consciousness, by nature, is without a self, and yet it does not have another base. No other basis. Yet consciousness has no other basis of emptiness. Yeah, so really, it's awkwardly translated. Actually, the internet translates it very well. Essentially, lacks substance. It, consciousness, has no other basis than insubstantiality. That's what it means. Consciousness is empty of a self. All experience is empty of a self. You can just do it right now. How many of you look out and see what's before you and say, this in the consciousness has a self? The experience has a self. So when we mean consciousness, we mean an experience. Where is the self in the experience? But if you put it in, then you'll say it's there. But actually, if you just look, and you've all done this thousands of times, you just look, you'll see there's no self in looking. There's no self in the hearing. Jeff, if you listen to music, in the listening of the music, is there any self in the listening to the music?
No.
Or is the self imputed into the listening? Imputed.
It's imputed by your emotional reactions and your visceral sensory, if it's too loud or if that type of thing.
Okay, but you don't even have to have a strong emotion. I want you to all try it. Let's just try it. Ready? You don't need a strong emotion. You don't need a weak emotion. You need nothing else. Just in the sound, is there a self? And then what I want you to do is I want you to do two things. When I ring the bell, I want you just to hear the bell. And then the next time, ring the bell and say, I am hearing the bell. And feel what the difference is. All right? Just try it. Now, try this. I am hearing the bell. Where is the I that's hearing the bell? It's really not hard.
It's just made up.
Completely, utterly made up. And yet, in an emotional situation, you're going to be saying, I heard that bell. Isn't that right? I heard that bell, and the way I heard it is the way I heard it. Yeah. Is it true? No. Could it be important for a legal case? Yes. Could it be important in sorting out something going on in the kitchen? Yes. Could it be important in sorting out a relationship? Yes. Could it be actually important in many matters? Yes. Is it ultimately true? No. That's why, you know, have you ever had written ironclad contracts written by lawyers and two parties completely see it differently and you thought it was completely understood? Not even close. Okay, one more. 33. By being close to a lodestone, an iron object swiftly moves forward, that is close to a magnet. A natural magnet, an iron object swiftly moves forward. It possesses no mind of its own, yet it appears as if it does. Why? Because it moves. If a tree moves, does it have a self? What would you say? If a tree doesn't move, does it have no self? If a tree does this, does have a self. I know people who do. Yeah. Because something's animated, it has self. It has a will of its own. No, it moves just like self, the appearance of a self, it moves through causes and conditions. I'll go to 34. Likewise, on page 4, 34, likewise, the foundational consciousness, the alaya vijnana, like the ocean, too, appears to be real, though it is false. In this way, it moves to and fro and retains the three realms of existence. So just because something's moving doesn't mean anything's happening. Just because you're moving down the highway actually doesn't mean anything's really happening. Just because there's waves moving on the ocean isn't really moving. Just because something does something, so here, well, let's get back to consciousness, which is where this is all founded on. Just because consciousness appears to take up and discard objects doesn't actually mean, because it appears to be moving, doesn't mean it has a self. That's the point. If the apple falls off the table, it doesn't mean it has a self actor. It's simply due to causes and conditions. Make sense to all of you? Who's putting up their arm? A self, or due to causes and conditions? When you lift up your foot, is there a self lifting up your foot? We normally say, I lifted up my foot. Is there a self lifting up the foot, or there's simply causes and conditions, and we attribute causes and conditions, complex causes and conditions, as a self? And this is the point that he's making, which is the heart of most emptiness meditations. Yeah? Sensing arising, sensing passing by, right? Everybody practiced, you know, Burmese or Thai Vipassana? Yeah? Rising, falling, rising, falling, rising, falling, rising, falling. There's a real thing rising and a real thing falling, correct? And there's a self observing it. Trees do the same thing. Rocks do the same thing. I've known people with, you know, if a rock splits apart, look, it's alive. It's breathing. No, it's simply due to cause and conditions. All right, I'm going to end there. Okay, there's one more. Okay, I'm not going to. There's 35. Just as the ocean and the trees move about through they possess no mind, likewise foundational consciousness too move about in dependence upon the body, dependence upon a body of interdependent sensory experiences. This is the heart of almost all insight meditation. Animated things that have no self but complex cause and conditions. Robots. Robots have selves? How about cars? If you look at cars moving about, would you say the cars have a self? Why not? Kind of appears to me like they have a self. They go here, they go there. How about cars now that are automated cars that have no drivers? What would you say? Self or no self? So why so badly do we need a self agent that's controlling ourselves and the universe? It emotionally feels right. I did this. No, you didn't do that. It was done through causes and conditions. If you take the I out of there, you understand it. If you put the I in there, you have an emotional situation. Which may be worth it under certain circumstances, but it's not real. Okay. So this interdependence business, interdependence is emptiness. It's one of the highest teachings of emptiness, way of experiencing emptiness. When you no longer see self agents and creators, but you see causes and conditions freely moving and creating and disappearing, you have a state of open emptiness, infinite emptiness. Change the conditions and everything changes. So listen to the stuckness and emotional stuckness of mind. Everybody, okay? Listen to the statement. Just listen to the emotional statement. I can't change. It's utterly impossible not to. I could never. It won't happen. Utterly impossible, isn't it? You think of all the infinite causes and conditions. I will never be the same again. That's correct. You're not the same from moment to moment anyways. So how could you be? So we come back again. Clinging and attachment is the cause of suffering. But actually, underneath that is the belief that concepts and appearances of the mind are actually real entities. We don't even need to use the word self. We just need to say real, lasting entities. No such thing. Real, lasting entities. There's no such thing. How do you feel about that? How do you emotionally feel about that? But I want a lasting self. I will have a lasting self. This is all due to me. I can't give a class, is that right? I can't give a class unless there's beings to interact with. I could sit in the room and give a class, yes? I could just be in the tar cabin, nobody in the tar cabin, just give a class. Is that a class? Or is it what's called a soliloquy, right? Just give a nice soliloquy, a class. So you're as much of this class as I'm this class and the text of the class. Whatever you're doing, interdependent on this being's history of conditioning and other factors, history and these texts, is how the class will appear. Bring in another teacher with a different set of history, it'll be a different class. Isn't that fantastic? That's really remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. Fantastic. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Lynn. Happy birthday to you. We want to know, Laurel has noticed that there are a lot of Librans, statistically large, almost impossible number of Librans here attending this retreat. Skewed. How is that possible? So many Librans have gathered here this 3 weeks. Very interesting. So we have a number of birthdays coming up. It's wonderful. Congratulations, Monique. May you live many, many more healthy, joyous, awakening, dharma-filled, exploratory years. Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, so let's see here tonight. Patricia. Would you be so interested and kind to lead a Padmasattva meditation? That'd be great. Wonderful. And I will continue on in prep for prep or no prep, both Dorothy Durlow. Great. For Saturday morning. Now, new time. So called. So you have enough meditative contemplations to do? Great. Keeps you off the streets of Kinmount.